France's interior minister says violent protests in Paris are under control despite ongoing disorderly acts he declared totally unacceptable. More from Lisa Bryant in Paris.
It's becoming a familiar sound and smell. Tear gas lobbed by riot police against so-called yellow vest protesters. Demonstrators sporting fluorescent yellow jackets were out in force again in Paris and across the country, protesting against a range of grievances, including low wages and high taxes. Around the iconic Champs-Élysées, demonstrators clash with police, set fire to barricades and attack stores. Armored vehicles rumble through the streets.
Lisa Bryant in Paris, and since the unrest began in November, in response to a sharp increase in diesel fuel taxes, four people have been killed in protest-related incidents. Despite repeated calls by President Trump for oil production to remain steady, the Saudi-led Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC, along with Russia and its allies, have announced they will cut their pumping of crude to reduce oil flows onto the global market by 1.2 million barrels per day, a bigger-than-expected cut. The latest impending White House high-profile departure is the chief of staff, who traditionally controls access to the Oval Office. Mr. Trump speaks.
John Kelly will be leaving, but I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy. John Kelly will be leaving at the end of the year. We'll be announcing who will be taking John's place. It might be on an interim basis.
And there had been speculation for months Kelly would leave soon. The former Marine general and the president have never had an overly warm relationship. This is VOA News. President Trump has confirmed Army General Mark Milley is his choice to replace Marine General Joseph Dunford as his next top military advisor and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. AP's Ben Thomas has more.
Milley is a battle-hardened commander, having led troops during several tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He served as the Army Chief of Staff for the last 3 years, during which time he oversaw the move of women into frontline infantry and combat positions. In February 2016, Milley told the Senate Armed Services Committee the Army's new standards for armor and infantry would be gender neutral.
And those are measured against one thing, neither male nor female. They're measured against the requirements of combat.
Milley is known as charismatic, outgoing, and unafraid to offer blunt assessments to Congress. Last year, he scolded the House Armed Services Committee for its inability to approve a defense budget, calling that professional malpractice. Ben Thomas, Washington.
A crackdown on political dissent in Turkey is widening the participants in a major civil unrest 5 years ago. Prosecutors have issued arrest warrants for a prominent actor, leading journalists, and civil society activists. The arrests are in connection with the 2013 protests. The unrest began over plans to turn a park in central Istanbul into a shopping mall. Those protests quickly transformed into broader demonstrations opposing the government and, in particular, then Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan. At its peak, the unrest saw millions of people take to the streets across the country. Yemeni rebel delegates at talks underway in Sweden, trying to end their country's civil war, have reported progress on the key issues of reopening the airport at the capital and the implementation of an agreement reached earlier this week on the exchange of prisoners. These are the first talks since 2016, and take place amid the growing humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Geert Kapileri, the UN Children's Agency regional director, said the children have suffered enough.
7 million children in Yemen today go hungry to bed. 1.8 million are acutely malnourished. 400,000 of them are facing the life-threatening form of severe acute malnutrition. Over 2 million children out of school in this country. Thousands of children being killed, injured, maimed for life.
The rebel Houthis captured Sana'a in 2014, forcing the government into exile and plunging the nation into civil war, which has killed tens of thousands and made Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with 22 of its 29 million in need of aid. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
I hope as we are maturing democracy and we are learning from our past mistakes, people can now wake up and hold people to explain, you know, and give exact details on some of their political pronouncements.
The Nigerian Christian Council plans to meet all presidential candidates beginning Monday.
We are in the process now of deploying people to the centers. We have printed the preliminary voters' roll, and this is what we are subject to the voter inspection exercise.
Prospective Malawian voters will start inspecting their information in the new voter list Monday.
South Sudan is not abiding by the cessation of hostilities. Is it not abiding by the permanent ceasefire? Is it proof? Or these are mere allegations and stories being created by people who are anti-peace?
And the Security Council calls on the South Sudanese government to hold accountable perpetrators of the recent sexual attacks in Rukoni County. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Christian Association of Nigeria plans to interact with presidential candidates beginning Monday ahead of the upcoming February presidential poll. Organizers say the aim is to get to know details about the plans of the candidates before the vote. It came after local media reports of divisions within the ranks of the Northern Elders Forum. The reporters say a section of the Northern Elders wants incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari to be re-elected, while the other section disagrees. For the latest political development, I read Chudi Chukwuani, an economist and political analyst based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
I believe there's no doubt that there's a division in the North. The section of the North believes that Buhari needs to continue. A major section in the North believes that there's severe hunger. And as a result of the severe hunger and lack of economic progress and the insecurity issues, especially dealing with Boko Haram, that Buhari should go and let another person come and try his hand on it. That is what is playing out in the North.
Do you think that could have any impact on his re-election bid?
I believe so. I believe that when you have such a division, obviously the election that packs on how people will vote, because people are now expressing their views. And I believe presidential debate will be helpful, because when there's a presidential debate, it will provide an opportunity for the electorate to be able to value and assess the candidates based on the counterpunches. Because obviously, the opposing candidates will raise the issue that you have not done anything.
Do you really anticipate a presidential debate between incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari and the main opposition challenger, Atiku Abubakar, the former vice president?
I believe if Nigerians rise up and call for it, it will happen. If Nigerians make it a condition of their voting for one side or the other, it will happen. If Nigerians coupled with the international community rise up and demand that we need to hear, we need to know what are your programs so that we can make an informed assessment on who we should back, I think it will happen. And I believe there's a presidential debate and or interaction that is currently ongoing that is being championed by the Christian Association of Nigeria. I just received an alert this afternoon informing me that there will be some form of interaction with the presidential candidate on Monday, the 10th of December, under the Christian Association of Nigeria. I think if we start having, you know, calls from major voting blocks in the nation, saying that we need to hear from those that aspire to lead us. We need to know what their programs are, and we want to know what are their views on all those things. I think it will happen.
On Friday, the former vice president got an endorsement from leaders of the Coalition of United Political Parties, or CUPP. How significant is this, and will there be any political boost for this endorsement?
Obviously, anytime anybody gets an endorsement, any endorsement, even if it is from one person, that is one towards vote. So it is significant. Any endorsement anybody gets in any political context is significant because it changes the coloration. It creates what we call the momentum, you know, of people moving to one side and finding confidence on one side. It's significant because in most contexts, you might be surprised. It should be decided by one vote.
The former vice president also said that if elected, he pledged to form a government of national unity. How feasible is this? And many political leaders in Nigeria have used this, yet when they get to office, they are unable to do it. What do you make of his pledge?
He has to be taken to task. People have to ask him now, what are the mechanics? Because most times when people make that statement of a government of national unity, it was just a word. There were no follow-ups. Nobody have asked them in the past to really say and put in detail what the mechanics of such a government will look like and tie them and hold them to it. So I believe now that he has said it, people should call upon him and demand that he announces what the mechanics are. And he now brings out the exact program on how that could work and what he intends to do. Maybe he will say, okay, you know what? I will divide my cabinet in this ratio. Maybe I will divide my appointment in this ratio. You know, those things have to be made known so that you can hold the person to it. You know, when the person gets to office, in the past, nobody has ever done that. They've all just said it as a political talk. But I hope as we are maturing democracy and we are learning from our past mistakes, people can now wake up and hold people to explain, you know, and give exact detail on some of their political pronouncements.
Chudi Chukwuani is an economist and political analyst. He spoke with me from Abuja. The Malawian Electoral Commission is calling on prospective voters to review their information on a new voter list beginning Monday. It's part of the electoral body's efforts to compile an updated list for next year's general election. Officials say the registration drive will run from December 10 to January 9, 2019. The electoral body also called on political parties and civil society to help ensure the transparency and credibility of the new voter list. For more, I read Sangwani Mwafulirwa, spokesperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission in the commercial capital, Blantyre.
We are done with the voter registration exercise. Now, as the requirement of the law, the Malawi Electoral Commission is supposed to open all the centers to provide an opportunity for everyone who registered to inspect their details. This gives an opportunity for us and all registered voters to double-check the data that we have captured so that if there are any deficiencies or any incorrectness, we should correct it now, unlike dealing with such matters on the polling day. I should also be quick to mention that this is the period we allow registered voters that have moved away from the areas where they registered to apply for transfers. You should understand that the law requires here that you vote where you register. So if someone has moved in between the time of registration and now, we give them an opportunity to go and process a transfer.
So Sangwani, how significant or important is this inspection phase of the voter registration process?
Well, apart from the three reasons that I've mentioned, that people should be double sure that the details in the voters' register are very correct and reflect their names and faces, you should know that for the coming elections, we migrated to a new system of biometric voter registration, whereby we captured their details, but then we had to get their data from the national register. Now, we would want people also to take special interest to ensure that the picture that has been used against their name in the voters' roll, it's really there. So it's really important that they have to come and check it.
Will political parties be part of this process to ensure transparency and that when the voter list is compiled to be used, they will not fault the system that somebody is trying to manipulate it in favor of one party or the other?
We have employed each and every strategy to make the election process as transparent as we can. During voter registration, the parties had placed their monitors. These monitors were capturing the statistics for each and every center or registration center we have. So going into voter verification, we were so expecting the party monitors to party political parties to place their monitors to monitor the exercise. And it's not only political parties, we also have civil society organizations. These will allow them to place their observers also. Why we are doing all this is to ensure that if an issue arises today or tomorrow, these monitors should be able to vote for us as to everything went on. At the same time, you should know that this time of voter verification, it's allowed that if you discover that one of the people that have been registered at such a center, they are not eligible to be registered there, you can file a challenge. So we really need the monitors to be placed by the political parties.
There are some speculations that the Electoral Commission will allow those who were not able to register during the period of the compilation to re-register in this period. Is it true?
According to our law, when we open for voter verification, we cannot do fresh registration. What it means is that those who never registered when we opened up for voter registration cannot come at the time of voter verification to register. So it means they have missed it this time around. They should wait for the next elections.
What assurances are you giving Malawians as you begin this process Monday?
From the Electoral Commission's point of view, we are well set and prepared. We have done the trainings. We are in the process now of deploying people to the centers. We have printed the preliminary voters' roll, and this is what we are subject to the voter inspection exercise. What we need now is for the people that are registered to go and inspect their details in the voters' roll.
Sangwani Mwafulerwa is the spokesperson for the Malawi Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from Blantyre. The South Sudanese government has rejected reports that armed men in military and civilian uniform raped more than 150 women and girls. Information Minister Michael Makui says the reports are aimed to undermine the administration. His comment came after the United Nations Security Council called on the South Sudanese government to condemn and hold accountable perpetrators of sexual attacks which occurred last year between November 22 and 29 in Robkoni County. But local media reports say officials denied rape occurred. For more reaction, I read South Sudanese Information Minister Michael Makui in the capital, Juba.
Government of South Sudan is not being managed by the UN, by the way. And there is no reason for the UN to call upon the government to do the obvious. South Sudan do not allow such offenses. They are offenses under the law. And now, when the UN passes such a resolution and demands, they would understand that the government of South Sudan is serious and sexual offenses are offenses under the South Sudanese laws. And a living example is the case of Terena Hotel, whereby the culprits were apprehended, investigated, and given their due sentence. What is particular about this is obvious that definitely the government is taking it up, if any at all. People should not act on reports which are written by scrupulous people, people who do not report issues correctly. What I'm saying is that if there is such a thing, then there is no reason for the UN to state the obvious, because the government of South Sudan does not condone, and the law will take its course.
The UN says from 22nd to 29th November, armed men in military and civilian clothing operating in government-controlled areas throughout Robkona County raped more than 150 women and girls, and they think these perpetrators have not been dealt with.
These are nonsense. These are stories which are just concocted. Let them come and prove the abuse you're supposed to report, and then action is taken against that person. These the reports which are written in the hotels are not reports.
So the government will not investigate it?
How did they manage with that figure of 150 women who have been raped or sexually abused? These are just mere stories being created because there are people who are working against the government of South Sudan that wishful South Sudan to be in peace, and as such, they do such things in order to discredit the agreement which we have signed. This is all that we know.
So you believe even the United Nations has teamed up with people or critics of your government?
Reports that go to the UN are written by human beings. And these sources, that right-side reports, are not sources to be recognized. Not just to rely on a report which was written by someone in a hotel, and then it is believed to be true, and then the government of South Sudan is managed as such. The offenses which are reported to have been committed are offenses that, if at all they are committed, they will be investigated and acted upon according to the law.
But, Mr. Information Minister, you said these are concocted to tarnish the reputation of your administration. But why wouldn't you investigate to find out the authenticity, if it is right or not?
These are stories that are concocted in an attempt to discredit those who are uniform. Have they been identified? After all, it is said by people who are in the government hell areas. Do you know where are the government hell areas in South Sudan and which ones are not government hell areas? These are unfortunate conclusions being reached without the least substantiation.
The Security Council called on the South Sudan leaders to meet without delay all commitment made under cessation of hostilities agreement, including to refrain from attacks on the civilian population and to refrain from any act of rape or sexual abuse.
Yes,
what do you make of it?
But is it confirmed? Is it now confirmed? Is it confirmed that the government of South Sudan is not abiding by the cessation of hostilities? Is it not abiding by the permanent ceasefire? Is it proof, or these are mere allegations and stories being created by people who are anti-peace?
Michael Makui is the South Sudanese Information Minister. He spoke with me from Juba. The International Telecommunication Union, ITU, reports for the first time in history, more than half of the world's population is using the internet. A new report finds the strongest growth is in Africa and the lowest in Europe and the Americas. For the UAE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The report finds access to and use of information and communication technologies around the world is trending upwards. It notes most internet users are in developed countries, with more than 80% of their populations online. But it says internet use is steadily growing in developing countries, increasing from 7.7% in 2005 to 45.3% this year. The International Telecommunication Union says Africa is the region with the strongest growth, where the percentage of people using the internet has increased from just over 2% in 2005 to nearly 25% in 2018. The lowest growth rates, it says, are in Europe and the Americas, with the lowest usage found in the Asia-Pacific region. In addition to data on internet usage, newly released statistics show mobile access to basic telecommunication services is becoming more predominant. ITU senior statistician Esperanza Magpante says access to higher-speed mobile and fixed broadband also is growing.
So there's almost 96% of the population who are now covered by mobile population signal, of which 90% are covered by 3G access. So this is a high figure, and this helps explain why we have this 51% of the population now using the internet.
With the growth in mobile broadband, Magpante says there's been an upsurge in the number of people using the internet through their mobile devices. The ITU says countries that are hooked into the digital economy do better in their overall economic well-being and competitiveness. Unfortunately, it says, the cost of accessing telecommunication networks remains too high and unaffordable for many. It says prices must be brought down to make the digital economy a reality for the half of the world's people who do not as yet use the internet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The
Zimbabwean biggest food processing company said it is closing its wheat mills as it cannot import the commodity because of foreign currency shortages. As Columbus Mavunga reports from the capital, Harare, analysts say the Zimbabwean land reform program is the root cause of this and is a development likely to further cause flour product shortages.
On Thursday, the CEO of National Foods Limited, Michael Lashbrook, told VOA that he hopes Zimbabwe's government will help the company pay wheat suppliers so that it does not have to close its flour mills. He said the government had made some local wheat available to millers, but he said quality bread flour required imported grain to be blended with local varieties. Panache Chikore was hoping to get a temporary job at the National Foods Limited during the Christmas season. He is disappointed to hear the company's mills have to close. When I was growing up, I looked forward to getting employment, or those who are employed would take care of others so that we all have a decent life, he says. It is only that things got tough. I wanted a decent job to make me survive, adds Chikore. Zimbabwe's economy has been ailing since the early 2000s when the country's farm sector went into a nosedive. Both cash and basic goods are increasingly in short supply, prompting calls for the government to fix the situation. Zimbabwe Farmers Union Executive Director Paul Zakaria says the wheat shortage is the result of controversial land reform program that displaced most white commercial farmers and rewarded black peasant farmers who had no experience and no resources to work the land.
When we had that adjustment in the resource that we call land, a lot of things in production and productivity in that sense was negatively affected. We saw the trends now going down from 2002 or 2001, when we hit a peak of 235,000 metric tons of wheat in Zimbabwe. We dipped to very, very low and pathetic levels of about 20,000 metric tons during the 2010 period up to the 2015 period.
He says Zimbabwe can produce sufficient wheat again under the right conditions.
Farmers in Zimbabwe, if they are supported adequately with the resources that are required, they can push the production levels to levels where the manufacturing capacity cannot even handle, because we used to do that.
For now, there are fears bread is going to disappear from store shelves and the price for wheat products will skyrocket, making life even more unaffordable for the average Zimbabwean citizen. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Hello, peepsters. Welcome to the weekend. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Boy, do I have a show for you. 55 minutes of cool, commercial-free, pan-African music. Hear your favorite current Afro beats. Discover new music from Ghana and meet Blinky Bill from Nairobi. He's just released a new album.
Even if you know a lot of things, there's no guarantee that you're gonna see it tomorrow.
Revel in earthy African classics from Mali, Cape Verde, DRC, and South Africa. All this and more this Sunday at 15:05 and 20:05 UTC. Just tune in to your local FM station and meet me there. Music Time in Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, Sierra Leone has been disqualified from the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying campaign because of government interference in the country's football association. This means Kenya and Ghana qualify for next year's Nations Cup finals from Group F. Sierra Leone were suspended from all football by FIFA in October. They have not played any qualifying matches since that ban. The ban was imposed after the country's anti-corruption commission barred Sierra Leone Football Association President Isha Johansson and General Secretary Christopher Kamara from the governing body's offices, though both deny any wrongdoing. With one match remaining in the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying campaign, Kenya are top of Group F on 7 points from 3 matches, with Ghana a point behind. Ethiopia are third on 1 point from 4 games and now cannot qualify. CAF is looking for new hosts for the 2019 Nations Cup after confirming on Friday that Cameroon had been stripped of hosting rights for next year's showpiece event. Meanwhile, Morocco's Raja Casablanca won the 2018 African Confederation Cup on Sunday, surviving a late fight back from DR Congo's AS Vita Club in the second leg of the final in Kinshasa to win 4-3 on aggregate. Raja brought a 3-0 first leg advantage with them, and despite a 3-1 defeat in the second leg in front of Vita Club's home fans, the Moroccans held on for the overall victory. Raja's coach, Juan Carlos Garrido, became the first man to win the African Confederation Cup with 2 clubs. The Spaniard also coached Al Ahly to a dramatic victory over Ivory Coast's San Pedro in the 2014 final of Africa's second-tier club competition. The preliminary round of this year's African Confederation Cup is already underway, with second-leg matches taking place on Tuesday and Wednesday. In athletics, Kenya's distant runner Eliud Kipchoge and Colombian long and triple jumper Catherine Ibagwen have been named Male and Female World Athletes of the Year. The pair were honored by the IAAF at a ceremony in Monaco. Britain's Dina Asher-Smith, who won 3 European sprint titles and relay gold at the Commonwealth Games, was nominated for the Women's Award. The 34-year Kipchoge won the London Marathon and set a world record of 2 hours, 1 minute and 39 seconds in Berlin. His time in the German capital bettered that of compatriot Dennis Kimeto, whose 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds was also set in Berlin in 2014. Ibagwen, who is also 34, claimed triple and long jump honors in the Central American and Caribbean Games, the Continental Cup, and the Diamond League finals. Also in athletics, Kenya's Maurice Kipserem and Ethiopia's Ababel Yashanen smashed their personal bests to secure victories at the inaugural Abu Dhabi Marathon on Friday. In a close race, Kipserem won in 2 hours, 4 minutes and 4 seconds to take more than 2 minutes off the personal best he set when winning the 2016 Rotterdam Marathon, moving him 12th on the world all-time list. During the week in which his recent World Half Marathon record was ratified, compatriot Ibrahim Kiptum finished second to also enter the top 20 on the world all-time list. Yashanen, meanwhile, won the women's race in 2 hours, 20 minutes and 16 seconds to finish comfortably ahead of Bahrain's Eunice Chumba, who clocked 2 hours, 20 minutes and 54 seconds. Finally, in women's football, African champions Nigeria have been drawn in Group A of the 2019 Women's World Cup, where they will face the hosts France. The Super Falcons won a 9th continental title out of 11 editions last weekend, beating South Africa on penalties in the Women's Africa Cup of Nations final, and will also face South Korea and Norway at next year's Global Showpiece event. Debutant South Africa will play in Group B alongside Germany, China and Spain. Cameroon are drawn in Group E with Canada, New Zealand and Netherlands. And in other interesting matchups, England will face neighbor Scotland in Group D, a group which also includes Argentina and Japan. Defending champions the United States will take on Sweden, Thailand and Chile in Group F. And Jamaica, who are also debutants, will face Australia, Italy and Brazil in Group C. The 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup will be held in France from June 7th to July 7th, with host France facing South Korea in the opening game on June 7th in Paris. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. And you will be here from Keys Daniel with African Girl, Madini Classic featuring Vivian with Nelly View, Malik Berry with The Waves, and followed by Mbongeni Ngema with My Baby. I buy you a Medusa, I give you two more later. I buy you a Medusa, I give you two more later. African boy, you call me magician boy. African boy, you call me magician boy. African boy, you call me magician boy. African boy, you know you want good love. Ain't nobody like you, baby, no. See nobody but only you. If I buy car, I go buy for two. Oh, baby, I go there for you. Yeah, yeah, there for you. This a body man, marama. Baby, oh, yeah, shake, baby, shake. For me, get your more appreciate it. If you go ahead, if you go ahead. This a body man, marama. Baby, oh, yeah, shake, baby, shake. For me, get your more appreciate it. If you go ahead. African boy, she call me magician boy. African boy, she call me magician boy. African boy, she call me magician boy. African boy, you know you want good love. You got it back to Capitan, Capitan, Capitan. You got it back to Capitan. You got it gun, Capitan. I can see them too. African boy, you got me magician boy. African boy, you got me magician boy. African boy, you got me magician.
niseme sio sawa. Ukweli ila kitandani hatari kukudenja usiniache baridi kipenzi si unajua mam sio sawa.
Live.
about you. Oh, I dey enter go bay, I don't enter go say. Shane, I cry to love you. Shane, I cry to kiss you. Oh, oh, Shane, I cry to hurt you. Girl, it's just me and you. Keep it secret, yeah, yeah.
like Beyonce. I like Genevieve, I think that she's so sweet. And Nadia Buari, cause she know the drink I read. It's not about you, know. You cannot blame me, though. I wanna have them all. I know it's wrong, but the truth is that I'm just an Oliva.
Oliva, Oliva, just an Oliva. Oliva, Oliva, say I'm just an Oliva. Oliva, Oliva, I'm just an Oliva.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America. But you heard from Dibanj, Oliver Twist. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Feverish debates continue all over Europe about the suggestion that looted African artworks over the continent should be returned to the country of origin. As may be recalled, President Macron of France had already ordered that French museum should return looted African arts to Africa, and they started with artworks to Burkina Faso. In this regard, the Senegalese have taken a step because those in Europe who are worried about returning stolen arts to Africa always argue that except for few countries, Africa lacks the infrastructure to host these African artworks. The president of Senegal, Macky Sall, recently inaugurated a museum of black civilization in the capital, Dakar. The idea of such a museum was first raised 50 years ago by the first Senegalese president, Léopold Senghor, a poet who understood the value of culture in the identity of the African people. He and the man called Césaire proposed the philosophy of negritude, which was intended to reject the imposition of French culture on black people in Africa and the Caribbean. But because of other priorities, a lack of funds, such a museum for black culture was not built. Now, with an investment of $34 million by China, this dream has been fulfilled, and the first opening will show artworks not only from Senegal, but from Mali and Burkina Faso. It is important that the African Union should pay more attention to this debate all over Europe. It is not just that there may not be funds, but cultural matters of importance to the African people. And just recently, in Belgium, the most brutal of colonial powers in the African continent, renovated a new museum at the cost of $73 million. And this museum had a very serious racist past. And it shows the brutality of Belgian colonialism. But when it was opened in Belgium, that museum was used to convince the Belgian people that colonialism was very good and that it had brought civilization to a savage African people. And now that the museum has been renovated, it has opened this debate as to whether the African arts in the African Museum in Belgium should be returned to the African people, mainly the Democratic Republic of the Congo or Rwanda. And when the museum was opened, King Philip was aware of the controversy, and he therefore decided not to attend the opening of the museum. The new director of the museum is aware of the debate, but is very skeptical of returning this museum to Africa, fearing that they lack the infrastructure and they do not have the staff. But now we have this new museum of black civilization in Dakar. It is possible to work out arrangements by an agreed timetable where many of these African arts all over Europe could be housed in this museum in Dakar temporarily until all the other African countries have been able to build the necessary infrastructure and staff to maintain it. This also will enhance, of course, tourism in Africa and now, of course, Senegal, which will open this museum not only to people of the African continent, but to the Caribbean, because black people are all over in the Caribbean and even in Latin America. If you go to Brazil, in the northeast of Brazil, many, many, many people of African origin are there, and they have their culture. When if you go there to Brazil and you see some of their museums reflecting African culture. So this is something which is important, and it may be necessary for Africans to begin to debate and to see that this proposal doesn't lie fallow. You cannot have a continent where 70% of its artworks are in Europe and we are doing nothing. So this is a major task, and it is important that the African Union should become engaged. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, when the door is closed, you must learn to slide across the crack of the sail. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McKee.